All right, welcome everybody. My name is Divine. This is episode 655 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, I'm going to continue the Occupational Medicine Board Review Series. So the first one that I made a few days back focused on the OSHA-led standard. Now this one is going to focus on the OSHA asbestos standard. Okay, on the OSHA asbestos standard. This one should hopefully be a little less complicated than the lead standard, but we'll see, right? And I'm gonna make lots of integrations as we go along, just to really help you understand things and, you know, be prepared from a board's perspective, right? And again, the OSHA asbestos standard, it's heavily tested on the occupational medicine boards, right? If you've been in residency for more than a few months, I'm almost certain you've probably heard about asbestos in some way, shape, or form, right? So what do the boards actually test, right? What do they actually test? They love to test the regulatory framework, you know, exposure limits, the work classifications, medical surveillance requirements, right? And how often do you need chest x-rays, right? Depending on your age or how long you've been exposed to asbestos, they really love to test this on the exams, right? So I think I want to maybe start off this podcast by, you know, starting off with something that honestly trips up a lot of test takers, right? The thing is, there's just not one OSHA asbestos standard. There's actually two, right? So we have 29 Code of Federal Regulations, 1910.1001, right? That covers general industry. And then we have 29 Code of Federal Regulations, 1926.1101. That covers construction, right? The thing is, they largely share the same core framework, but the thing is, the construction standard is far more heavily tested, right? Because think about it. That's where the overwhelming majority of asbestos exposure happens, in construction, right? You know, renovation, demolition of older buildings, right? So when you see a board vignette about asbestos, it almost always involves a construction worker or a person that, you know, works in a shipyard, right? Or someone doing some kind of renovation, right? So again, don't forget, two standards exist. Construction, that's 1926.1101. That's more board tested than general industry. So again, we got to know the numbers. As I discussed for lead, let's talk about the numbers for asbestos, right? So let's get the numbers into your head, right? Let's get the numbers into your head, right? So what's the PEL for asbestos, right? The permissible exposure limit. It's 0.1 fibers per cubic centimeter as an 8-hour time-weighted average. Literally, write that down right now. 0.1 cubic fibers per cubic centimeter as an 8-hour time-weighted average. The short-term exposure limit, the STEL, is 1.0 fibers per cubic centimeter over any 30-minute period. It's not an 8-hour time-weighted average over any 30-minute period, right? And here is where test takers begin to get confused with these numbers, right? The thing is, the action level for asbestos is also 0.1 fibers per cubic centimeter, right? So literally, the PEL and the action level are numerically the same. This is something that is very unusual. Many times the action level is about half the PEL for most OSHA standards, but that's not the case here, right? Here, the PEL and the action level are numerically the same. So what's the difference? Remember, the action level is basically the threshold that triggers two specific things, literally triggers two specific things, right? Periodic air monitoring and enrollment in medical surveillance, right? Periodic air monitoring, enrollment in medical surveillance, right? The PEL is the threshold that you cannot exceed, right? If you exceed the PEL, then it requires you to have engineering controls, right? So being at or above the action level for 30 or more days per year requires you that, hey, you're going to enroll that worker in the surveillance program, right? In the surveillance program. So again, just to summarize, the PEL is 0.1 fibers per cubic centimeter as an 8-hour time-weighted average. The STEL, the short-term exposure limit, is 1 fiber per cubic centimeter over any 30-minute period. The action level is 0.1 fibers per cubic centimeter. It's the same as the PEL, right? But again, it kind of triggers different obligations in a sense, right? So like, for example, the PEL, again, 0.1 fibers per cubic centimeter, 8-hour time-weighted average, it triggers engineering controls. Engineering controls are required once you go above the PEL. Right? The STEL, right? 1 fiber per cubic centimeter, right? Is over any 30-minute time frame. This cannot be exceeded in any 30-minute window, right? And then the action level, again, is also 0.1 fibers per cc, right? Per cubic centimeter, right? 8-hour over an 8-hour time weighted average, right? It triggers monitoring and medical surveillance, right? You need to enroll those workers in monitoring and medical surveillance, right? So again, please don't forget the PEL. I've said this like three times now. The PEL and the action level, they're the same number, right? The laws, the boards, they really love to attest that, you know, that, hey, if you go above the PEL, it triggers engineering controls are required. If you go above the action level, it triggers monitoring and medical surveillance, right? But one number is not lower than the other. All right. So now let's talk about the work classifications in construction. They love to test this. Many resources don't address this, but it's actually very high yield to know for the boards, right? This is a section that shows up quite frequently on the in board vignettes, right? So you really want to pay close attention, right? So the thing is, the construction standard actually does use a classification system for asbestos work, right? It uses class 1 through class 4, right? What's this classification for? Well, the thing is, it basically goes from highest risk to lowest risk, right? So your job on the boards is to hear a job description in a vignette and immediately know, hey, this is the class this falls into, right? So what's class 1? Well, class 1 is going to be the highest risk category, right? Basically, it involves, you know, removal of, you know, thermal system insulation. You know, I'm going to call this TSI. I don't want to keep saying thermal system insulation throughout this podcast, right? So TSI, right? And, you know, surfacing asbestos-containing material. I'm going to call that ACM. So TSI means thermal system insulation. ACM just means asbestos containing material, right? So basically, if you are a person that removes TSIs and surface ACMs, right, then you're going to be in class one, right? So TSI is like the pipe insulation, the boiler wrap, the duct insulation. You know, this was pretty common in buildings, you know, built before 1980. We do things differently now. Now, surfacing ACMs, right, this includes, like, again, basically like asbestos on surfaces, right? So like sprayed on fireproofing, you know, textured ceiling materials, right? Class one requires the most controls, right? Whenever you're doing a class one job, right, a competent person has to be on site. That's like extremely important. Competent person has to be on site. You need to have full containment. You need negative pressure enclosures, and you often need like a certified industrial hygienist. You're doing class one work, you better have good people around you, right? Now, class two is basically removal of other ACM that is in TSI or surfacing material. So if you're removing asbestos containing material that is not TSI or surfacing material, right? So think of things like, you know, like floor tiles, roofing felt, you know, sheet gaskets, you know, siding, right? It's still significant risk, still requires controls, but not as stringent as class one. And then class three is repair and maintenance work. Repair and maintenance work where you may encounter asbestos containing materials incidentally, right? You may disturb those things incidentally, right? This is the classic vignette scenario you're going to see on the boards. Is you're going to see like a plumber that is cutting through a wall to, you know, access a pipe and, you know, inadvertently disturbs asbestos, like an asbestos containing like joint compound or ceiling tile, right? The worker did not intend to disturb asbestos, but they did. That's going to be class three. And then class four is basically people that do custodial work in areas where there's asbestos containing material, right? So like, for example, you're sweeping up debris near asbestos containing materials, you are cleaning up areas, you know, where class one or class two work has occurred, right? It's the lowest risk, but it's still regulated, right? Class four, honestly, just only requires like 2 hours asbestos awareness training. And that number is definitely more testable. I'd certainly know that if I were you, right? So again, let's kind of summarize. Remember, again, class one, TSI and surfacing ACM removal, right? So the classic example is like, you know, abating pipe insulation. You're going to need 32 hours of a full asbestos abatement course, right? At least the supervisor. Right. And then class two is if you're doing other ACM removal that is not TSI or surface material. Right. So, you know, like, for example, like floor tile or, you know, removing of roofing. This requires a 16-hour course at the minimum. And then class three is repair, maintenance, you know, incidental disturbance. So like, for example, the classic board question is a plumber that is cutting through an ACM wall. That requires a 16-hour course as well. And then class four is just custodial work near ACM, right? So like, for example, you're sweeping near ACM, near asbestos debris. This requires 2-hour awareness training, okay? So again, remember the class four 2-hour awareness training number, they love to test it, right? Custodial workers, class four, remember, 4 divided by 2 is 2. That may be a nice way to remember that, right? So let's look at a class three scenario. Let's give an example, right? So let's say you have a 45-year-old maintenance worker, right? He's repairing a leaky pipe in a, you know, like a 1960s office building. And then as he's cutting through the drywall to assess the pipe, he disturbs the joint compound, right? Disturbs the joint compound, and that thing is found to contain like 2% of chrysotile asbestos, right? Wasn't wearing respiratory protection at the time. What class of work did this represent, and what should the employer have done? Well, it's class three work, right? It's class three work, incidental disturbance of ACM, you know, during repair and maintenance, right? The employer should have done a hazard assessment before the work began, right? And if, you know, ACM was identified or assumed, you know, in this circumstance, the worker should have been provided with respiratory protection, you know, like a half-face APF 10 respirator, right? And you should have also used WEF methods, right, to, you know, prevent the person from, you know, again, being at least minimize asbestos exposure, right? And a competent person should have been designated. And I'm going to talk about what a competent person is in a bit. All right. So the next thing I think I want to discuss here is medical surveillance, right? Who qualifies for a medical surveillance with asbestos, and what does it include? What does it include, right? So the thing is, medical surveillance is one area that the boards, they just love to test your knowledge of specific thresholds, right? So let's walk through exactly who qualifies. Who is going to qualify for medical surveillance? Again, what's the enrollment trigger? Well, again, an employee must be enrolled in any one of three conditions, right? So any one of three conditions applies, right? So number one, if you have exposure at or above the action level, right? Again, 0.1 fibers per cubic centimeter for 30 or more days per year, you enrolled, right? That 30-day threshold is very important, right? So if a worker is exposed above the action level on 29 days per year, technically that doesn't meet the threshold, right? Although in practice, you'd probably want to enroll them anyway, right? Just better safe than sorry. But the threshold is 30 days, right? What's the second trigger? Second trigger is the worker is required to wear a negative pressure respirator. The worker is required to wear a negative pressure respirator, right? So this includes, you know, half face, full face, air purifying respirators, right? Even if their measured exposure is still below the action level, the physiologic demand of the respirator wear is enough to require medical clearance, right? So that's something you definitely need to know. Now, what's the third trigger? The third trigger is you have a worker that has evidence of asbestos-related disease on a prior exam, right? Once they're in the program, they stay. Once they have evidence of asbestos-related disease, they basically stay in this medical enrollment program, right? So please, again, this the 30th per year threshold that is classic boards material, they love to test it, right? And then remember, again, negative pressure respirator use, that's an independent trigger, regardless of the measured exposure, right? So please keep that in mind. So what does the exam entail? What does this exam actually entail? Well, the thing is, it typically includes like a, you know, detailed occupational and medical history like you do for any patients that you see, right? You know, we're going to focus on respiratory symptoms, prior asbestos exposure, right? And then you're going to do a physical exam and you're going to emphasize the respiratory system, right? And then you're also going to do PFTs, pulmonary function testing. You're going to check out the FEC, the FEV1, right? And you're going to do a chest x-ray using the ILO classification system, right? The International Labor Organization classification system. I'm going to talk about that in the next segment, although I'm not going to go too deep in the weeds on that because that's not crazy testable, right? So one thing I want to say though is kind of a confidentiality point that the boards love to test, right? So the thing is, the physician, his job is to provide a written medical opinion to the employer, but that opinion is actually very limited, right? The employer, the only thing they learn is, hey, whether the worker is medically fit for the job, whether there are any limitations, whether the worker was informed of the results, right? Well, the actual diagnosis, right? So what does the employer get, right? They only learn if the worker is medically fit for the job, whether there's any limitations, whether the worker was informed of the results, right? Well, the actual diagnosis, like, hey, asbestosis, pleural plaques, whatever they found, that's kept confidential. That's between the physician and the worker. Okay, so again, the written medical opinion to the worker contains only fitness for duty information, right? Specific diagnoses, those are completely confidential to the worker, right? So again, let's run through these enrollment triggers really quickly again. Again, if you have exposure at or above the action level, right? Again, the threshold is 0.1 fibers per cc for 30 or more days per year, right? If you use a negative pressure respirator, any kind of use, regardless of exposure level, triggers medical enrollment, right? If you have prior asbestos-related disease, any prior positive finding, then yes, you're going to be on the medical enrollment, right? So now let's talk about chest x-ray frequency. I think that's kind of like a big thing to actually know for your boards, right? So the chest x-ray frequency, right? The ILO table, right? We're going to talk about this, right? This is probably like, honestly, one of the highest yield tables in, you know, that you should know for your exams. And I'm going to kind of work through it logically in a way that will help you remember it, right? So OSHA doesn't just say get a chest x-ray. It tells you exactly, you know, how often, right? And it's based on two variables. There are two variables that determine this. The worker's age and the number of years since your first asbestos exposure. Your age and the number of years since your first asbestos exposure, right? So understanding how these two variables interact is actually very helpful if you want to answer veneer questions correctly, right? So what's the logic? What's the rationale behind this? What's like the logic behind this? Well, the thing is this, right? The thing is, the risk of asbestos-related disease that can be detected on radiography is going to increase with both age and cumulative exposure time, right? So the thing is, this surveillance interval, it pretty much tightens, right? So, you know, x-rays being ordered more frequently as both of those factors increase, your age and your length of exposure to asbestos, right? So the interval never gets shorter than 1 year. It will always be a year, at least a year, right? And it only tightens when both conditions are met. You know, the worker is, you know, 45 or older and, you know, has at least, you know, 10 years since their first exposure, right? So I'm going to give you like the way I remember the table, right? So I remember three age ranges. That's the first thing you should remember. Less than 45, 45 to 54, and 55 or greater. I'm going to say that again. Memorize three age ranges: less than 45, 45 to 54, and 55 or older, okay? And then remember, less than 10, so we've talked about the ages, right? That's the first variable. Second variable is the year since first exposure. The year since first exposure, okay? The year since first exposure. Memorize three ranges: less than 10 years, 10 to 19 years, and 20 years or more, okay? Less than 10 years, 10 to 19 years, and 20 years or more, okay? And then I want you to remember these two numbers: 555-521. 555-521. 555-521. If you remember this, you're golden. You're golden, right? So again, let me kind of break this down, right? So I said memorize three age ranges: age less than 45, 45 to 54, and 55 plus. And then for years since first exposure: less than 10 years, 10 to 19 years, 20 years or greater. And then what do I mean by 555-521? 555 refers to the number of years. So now it's almost like you've made like a almost like a 3x3 table in a sense, right? The ages are at the top, and then the screen the years since first exposure are on the left side, right? 555 just means, hey, how frequently do you get a chest X-ray for the less than 10-year bracket, right? It's 5 years for people under 45, 5 years for 45 to 54, 5 years for 55 plus, 555, right? But obviously, when it's 10 to 19 years, it's going to be more frequent. That's where the 521 number comes in. It's 5 years for the less than 45 people. It's 2 years for the 45 to 54 people. And it's 1 year for the 55 plus folks. And then you may be wondering, Divine, but there was a third part here where it's been, if it's been 20 plus years since your first exposure. Well, guess what? That also has the same intervals as the 10 to 19 years. It's also 521. So 5 years for the under 45, 2 years for the 45 to 54, and then every year for the 55 plus group. That's it. If you know that, you're good to go. You are good to go. You are good to go. Okay, so again, remember, the tightening of the interval occurs when you're both over 45 or more, right? And your years of exposure are, you know, 10 or more years, right? 10 or more years, right? Again, either factor alone doesn't tighten the interval, right? Both are taken into consideration, right? So let's maybe do a few vignettes just to really, really cement this information in your brain, right? So let's say they give you a question about a 42-year-old insulation contractor, right? That was first exposed to asbestos at age 22, right? He has 20 years of documented exposure, right? How often should he receive a chest X-ray? Well, think about this. It should be every 5 years, right? Again, this person has been exposed for 20 years, but his age is still under 45, right? So the interval is 5 years for literally everything, right? Again, age is like the gating factor when the worker is young, right? Let's do another vignette, right? So what if they give you a 48-year-old shipyard worker exposed first at age 35, right? And, you know, you're told that he has 13 years since his first exposure. How often should he receive a chest X-ray? Well, it should be every 2 years. It should be every 2 years, right? Because number one, he's in the 45 to 54 age bracket, right? So it's in the mid. He's in the middle, right? And he has 10 to 19 years since first exposure, right? Remember 5-2-1. Two is in the middle, right? So both conditions are met. So interval tightens to every 2 years, right? And then what if they give you a question about like a 58-year-old construction worker first exposed at age 28, right? And he has 30 years since his first exposure. How often should he receive a chest X-ray? It should be every year, right? Think about it. He's 55 plus, right? And he's had 20 plus years since exposure. Remember 5-2-1, number one, remember the one is at the end, right? So this person is going to get the maximum surveillance frequency, right? And then what if they give you a question about like a 56-year-old facilities manager, you know, first exposed to asbestos at age 52, you know, during like a building renovation project, right? And you're told that, oh, he has like 4 years since his first exposure. How often should he receive a chest x-ray? What do you think? I hope you're saying, Divine, it's going to be every 5 years. It's going to be every 5 years, right? He's 55 plus, but he has fewer than 10 years since first exposure. Remember 555, right? So again, both conditions must be met. Look at the age and the frequency, and the, whenever you're answering these questions, look at the age and the length since first exposure, right? So again, age alone is not sufficient, right? So age alone is not sufficient to tighten the interval. You need both, consider both, right? So this person is going to be every five years, right? Now, a common board veneer trap is, again, they'll give you an older person with a short exposure history, right, and see if you're incorrect in tightening the interval, right? Again, the answer is going to be every 5 years. If you're a person that's older, 55 plus, you've been exposed for less than 10 years, the interval is every 5 years. All right, now the thing is, I'm going to talk about the ILOB reading. Again, I'm going to talk about it very cursory detail. You don't need to know this in crazy detail for your exams, right? But the thing is, OSHA, they specifically require that the x-ray be read using the International Labor Organization system, right? And the reader must be a B reader, right? It basically is a physician certified by NIOSH in ILO classification, right? Not just any radiologist, a B reader, right? And what does this system use? Well, it basically grades parenchymal opacities by shape and size, right? So, you know, S, T, and U for irregular opacities, right? You know, which is what you basically see in asbestosis, right? And P, Q, and R for rounded opacities, right? So S, T, U, like STU, for irregular opacities, and then P, Q, R for rounded opacities, right? Pleural changes, those are graded completely separately, right? But the key thing to know here is, if you have a finding of 1-0 or greater for parenchymal opacities, that's generally the threshold for a positive film, right? That's a positive film. You need to be referred to a pulmonologist at that point, right? And one word you may see is this word called profusion, P-R-O-F-U-S-I-O-N, right? It's basically the ILO term for the density of opacities, right? Higher profusion means you have much more advanced disease, right? So again, remember, please, ILO reads must be performed by a NIOSH certified B reader, okay? By a NIOSH certified B reader. All right. Now, let's talk about the spectrum of disease with asbestosis and, you know, the interaction between smoking and asbestos, right? So let's kind of, you know, anchor the regulatory content to clinical diseases, right? You need to know the five major, you know, asbestos-related conditions. You definitely need to know them for your exams. You know, you want to know the latency periods, right? And you want to know the distinguishing features, right? So asbestosis is what we're going to talk about, right? So the latency is 10 to 20 years, right? What are you going to see? Well, you're typically going to see, like, you know, bilateral basilar, you know, interstitial fibrosis, right? So remember, asbestos affects the base of the lungs, not the apex, the base. Most of the pneumoconiosis do the apex of the lungs, but asbestos does the base, right? And you know, the this is dose dependent, right? Typically that's going to require heavy long-term exposure, right? Now, mesothelioma, the latency is like 20 to 40 years, right? Typically it's going to involve the pleural, you know, the pleural lining. Sometimes it can actually involve the peritoneal lining, right? And remember, asbestos is much, much greater than smoking as a cause. In fact, let me tell you this. Smoking basically does not increase your risk of mesothelioma on the board exams. It's asbestos that increases that risk, right? And there's no dose threshold, right? Even brief exposure to asbestos can increase your risk of mesothelioma, right? And then lung cancer, right? The latency is about 15 to 35 years, right? And there's a multiplicative risk with smoking, right? So asbestos raises your risk by like tenfold, smoking by like, you know, 5 to 9-fold, right? So there's like a 50 to 90-fold increased risk of lung cancer if you have asbestosis, and if you're exposed to asbestos and you smoke, right? In fact, like whenever you see a physician for an exam and you're asbestos exposed, they tell you that, hey, smoking not good for you. Smoking not good for you, right? And then also pleural plaques, right? Pleural plaques, the latency can be anywhere from 10 to 30 years, right? So typically you're going to see, like, you know, just all these parietal pleural plaques. Many times they're calcified. This is usually a marker of exposure to asbestos, right? It's not pre-malignant. It's just a marker of asbestos exposure, right? And then one thing I want to mention is that, what is the earliest finding? This is number five. What is the earliest finding in a person that has been exposed to asbestos, right? The earliest lung finding you may see, it's going to be a benign pleural effusion. That's actually pretty high yield to know for your exams, right? And again, remember, mesothelioma, like I said, has no dose threshold, right? They love to test this on the Occ Med boards, right? Has no dose threshold, right? So if a person was a shipyard worker, very brief asbestos exposure decades ago, they can still develop mesothelioma. There's no safe level, right? This is very different from asbestosis, right? Which requires, you know, very heavy, you know, very prolonged exposure, right? And then again, don't forget that multiplicative risk between smoking and lung cancer, between smoking and asbestos, right? Really, really jacks up your risk of lung cancer. It's one of those multiplicative relationships that exists in biostatistics, right? So you should certainly keep this in mind for your exams, right? So what if they give you a question about like a 62-year-old, you know, former, you know, boilermaker presents for evaluation, right? And you're told that, hey, he was heavily exposed to asbestos in a shipyard from age, you know, 25 to 45, right? And he has smoked one pack per day for 30 years. He quit at age 55, right? What's the most important intervention you know that he should have been offered during his working years and why? The most important intervention should have been smoking cessation counseling, right? Because the thing is, again, smoking and asbestos, they interact multiplicatively for your risk of lung cancer, right? So if you eliminate the smoking component, because it's multiplicative, remember, there's a difference between 10 times 5 and 10 plus 5, right? 10 plus 5 is additive, that's 15. 10 times 5 is 50, right? Whenever something is being multiplied, big extreme effects, right? So the thing is, if you eliminate the smoking component, that dramatically reduces the person's absolute risk, right? So this intervention is going to have a much greater impact in asbestos-related workers than in the general population, right? So keep that in mind. Now, as we begin to slowly wrap up this podcast, I'm going to talk about the different fiber types for asbestos. They do like to talk about it on the exams, right? So remember, it's a conceptual anchor. Think of it more conceptually than trying to memorize this, right? So the thing is, there are two major categories of asbestos fibers, right? There's the serpentine fibers and there's the amphiboles, the serpentine fibers and the amphiboles, right? So chrysotile is honestly the only commercially significant serpentine fiber you should know, right? It's basically white asbestos, right? It basically accounts for about 95% of all the asbestos that has ever been used commercially, right? And it's kind of curly, right? And because it's curly, it makes it easy for the lungs to get rid of it, right? So the mucociliary system of the lungs can get rid of it pretty efficiently over time, right? Although, don't get me wrong, chrysotile, right? C-H-R-Y-S-O-T-I-L-E, right? Very strongly, still strongly associated with asbestosis and lung cancer, but it's considered somewhat less potent because, again, it can be gotten rid of pretty easily, right? Now, what is the big scary one? Those are the amphiboles, A-M-P-H-I-B-O-L-E-S, right? These are things like crocidolite, amosite, tremolite, anthophyllite, actinolite, right? These are like the colored asbestos fibers, right? The blue and the brown asbestos types, right? They're straight, they're rigid, they're very biopersistent, right? So they stay in the lung for decades. They don't go anywhere, right? And honestly, of all these things I mentioned, all the lights and lights and lights I mentioned, the big one you should really know is crocidolite, C-R-O-C-I-D-O-L-I-T-E, right? That's the blue asbestos. That's the most carcinogenic, most strongly associated with mesothelioma, right? If a vignette mentions a shipyard work or naval insulation, you know, from the 50s through the 70s, think of high-dose amphibole exposure. Think of high-dose amphibole exposure, right? So again, remember, crocidolite, blue asbestos, that is the most carcinogenic, right? Most strongly associated with mesothelioma, right? Chrysotile is like 95% of, you know, commercial use, right? And amphiboles tend to be biopersistent, right? Those are kind of big things to know for your exams, okay? Now, so let's, you know, just to kind of wrap this up, let's talk about some controls, some housekeeping, and the EPA. How does the EPA, because the EPA actually has an integration with the OSHA asbestos standard, right? So let's kind of walk through this, right? So the thing is, remember your controls, right? This is very heavily, commonly tested on the boards, right? So remember, you know, local exhaust ventilation, wet methods to suppress, you know, the release of fibers, using HEPA vacuums for cleanup, right? And please, I want to maybe make a quick stop here, right? This is a classic board strap. You never use a regular vacuum to clean up asbestos. You use a HEPA vacuum. You use what? A HEPA vacuum, right? So standard vacuums, they're going to release the fibers back into the air through their exhausts, right? It's only a HEPA-filtered vacuum that is appropriate for asbestos cleanup, right? And again, remember, respirators, they come after engineering controls are maximized, right? So please, regular vacuums are prohibited for asbestos cleanup. You got to use HEPA-filtered vacuums. Okay, this is one of the most commonly tested wrong answer choices on the boards, right? So in terms of waste disposal, right? So the thing is, if you want to dispose of asbestos, you need to dispose of it in impermeable labeled bags, right? And they're going to have OSHA and EPA asbestos warning labels. They're going to have OSHA and EPA asbestos warning labels, right? No dry sweeping, no compressed air for cleaning. No, right? And again, remember, you need to know the EPA side of this whole equation, right? So again, remember, OSHA governs worker protection, but the EPA, they have their own asbestos regulation under something known as NESHAP, N-E-SHAP. N-E-S-H-A-P, right? That alphabet soup just means, you know, the National Emission Standard for Hazardous Air Pollutants, right? We find that in 40 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 61, right? So if you're renovating or, you know, doing demolition of, you know, buildings with regulated asbestos-containing materials, the building owner, the building operator, they must notify the appropriate state environmental agency at least 10 working days before they begin work. At least 10 working days before they begin work, right? So this is the EPA OSHA integration that they love to test on the boards, right? So again, remember, OSHA protects workers, but EPA through their NESHA program, right? Air emissions, building demolition, you know, you need to notify at least 10 working days advance notice to the state agency before you renovate or demolish an ACM container building, all right? So again, please just make sure you know this stuff, right? Make sure you know this stuff. Remember, again, the PEL, 0.1 fibers per cubic centimeters, right? It's also the same thing as the action level over an 8-hour time-weighted average, right? The construction standard is more frequently tested than the general industry standard, right? Remember, class 4 custodials, right? 2 hours awareness training, that's a testable number. They love to test it, right? Again, for surveillance enrollment, 30 days per year, right? If you use negative pressure respirators, right, that's an independent surveillance trigger, right? And again, remember, the chest x-ray frequency tightens only when age is 45 or greater and your years of exposure is 10 or greater, right? Both are required, right? And then remember, an ILOB reader is required, not just any radiologist, right? Mesothelioma, there's no dose threshold, right? Any kind of asbestos exposure, even if it's short, brief, can increase your risk of mesothelioma, right? Smoking and asbestos, you know, lung cancer risk is multiplicative, it's not additive, right? Pleural plaques are not pre-malignant, they're just a marker of asbestos exposure. Remember, the first finding on a chest radiograph in a person that's been exposed to asbestos is a benign pleural effusion, right? And then remember, crocidolite, C-R-O-C-I-D-O-I-L-I-T-E, is the most carcinogenic asbestos fiber, right? And remember, you can only use HEPA vacuums. Regular vacuums are prohibited for asbestos cleanup, right? And then remember the EPA NESHAP, right? Again, 10 working days notice before you do any demolition or renovation of a building that contains asbestos containing a material, right? Again, I just kind of put this high yield rapid review at the end to kind of tie things together for you, right? So this is the end of this podcast. Again, I really hope you found this to be helpful. So just study this material. Shows up a lot on the boards, right? I won't be going over it if it was not boards relevant, right? So I'll see you, God willing, in episode in the next OMBR podcast, right? It's going to be OMBR S3, right? Where I talk about something else that is OCMED boards testable. All right. So thank you. Have a wonderful day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.